everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Brian Beeler. Today, we've got a really interesting case study on remote data collection. And I know we just talked about the Ducks Unlimited Canada and their remote data collection. Well, we found a way to get one step further away than the Great White North, and that is the British Antarctic Survey. And Jeremy Ropes joins us here to talk about a little bit of that. Jeremy, thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
No problem. Hi, Brian.
So what is the British Antarctic Survey in a nutshell?
We are a scientific research organization that's funded through the UK's research and innovation body, which in turn is funded from the UK government. And we operate some Antarctic research stations and a science ship, science logistics ship, the Sir David Attenborough.
And so you've got a combination of permanent or semi-permanent bases in the Antarctic, and then you've got ships that transport, you know, scientists and have sensors back and forth. What is it about the Antarctic that's so important from a UK perspective?
So there is a little bit of political history to this. The British Antarctic Survey was actually set up just after during the Second World War. There was military presence in Antarctica to look for German submarines. That then became the Falkland Island Dependency Survey, which then became the British Antarctic Survey. And because of the Antarctic Treaty, where all nations have agreed to not claim Antarctica, but to share it, to protect the environment and to share it for scientific research. BASS is the British representative of that. So we operate scientific bases in Antarctica because the Antarctic has an enormous influence on the world's climate. There's a lot of interesting space research that can be done from Antarctica because it's far away from man-made pollution, light pollution, radio pollution, and so forth. And there's a lot of biological research that we do in Antarctica because of the unique environment and the unique animals that we find there.
Yeah, that's really interesting. What's the UK's footprint, I suppose? Is your commitment to Antarctic research, you know, average amongst the G7 or whatever the equivalent benchmark is? Are you guys overweight on this? Just what's the scale?
We are relatively large, I think. We're relatively overweight, as you say. Obviously, the Americans are the biggest in terms of bases and scientific kit, but I think the UK is a large part of the other sort of advanced nations. The whilst we don't, you know, nobody owns any part of Antarctica, the British claim that is now, you know, void because of the Antarctic Treaty is about a quarter of the continent. There's a large chunk there, and we have bases from the Antarctic Peninsula all the way round to sort of our Halley Station is roughly zero longitude. So we have a large sort of range, and we do, but we do a lot of research, and it's a very collaborative space. Is Antarctica? We do a lot of research. There's a big project going on the Thwaites Glacier program at the moment that's being done with the National Science Foundation in America, and we do collaborate with lots of other countries there.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, and I know you've been, so I want you to give me some personal experience on Antarctica in a moment, but help us understand your data flow, because I think that's what's really interesting. We talk with IT vendors all the time about data collection at the edge and analytics at the edge. I mean, you guys, the moon is perhaps the next most furthest away in terms of data collection at the edge. And, like you say, you often use the area down there as a simulation for lunar exploration too, which is pretty cool. But you've got these bases that are they permanent, semi-permanent? How do you describe the structures that are there at this point?
They're all permanent. Most of them are all year round occupied. We have one station on Cygni Island that's occupied only during the Antarctic summer. But all the rest are occupied by people all year round. The main season is the Antarctic summer, which is roughly October through till April, May, although it varies slightly on location. And then over the winter period, you'll have a smaller team of people just to keep the station going and to do some research. So you may be anywhere from four people at our smallest base up to 20, 30 people at our largest base.
And so they're running active research projects on obviously climate, I'm sure, and all sorts of other things. And when you looked at what's going on at the bases, I imagine you have hundreds, if not thousands, of sensors and devices that are all out there collecting data. How does that data flow work from, this extreme edge? Do you funnel it all back from, is it wireless? Are you running SD cards from sensors back to the bases? Like how does it work at the sensor level? And then what's the first step of centralization in your data?
So yes, yeah, so we have lots of sensors, as you say, at the Antarctic stations and our research ships. We have not only sensors at the stations, we have lots of automated sensors, weather stations, and various different types of sensor equipment spread out across the Antarctic continent. We have satellite links. They're very low bandwidth satellite links. In the case of the deep field, the deep Antarctic sensor locations, they use Iridium. It's really the only satellite link you can get to that location, and that's very, very low. We're talking 2,000 bits per second there. It's absolutely tiny. and really, you can't send back hardly any data over that kind of link. We'll send back status updates to let us know that the instruments are still there, they're still working. There might be...
Right, you get a heartbeat.
Absolutely.
Right?
There might be very small things like... You do manage to get back webcam pictures, obviously low res webcam pictures, but that can be useful just so you know what's going on. If there's a big storm is showing in the images over several days, and then something happens, you've got an idea of maybe the thing's been buried in the snow or something. Yeah, you've got the basic status displays and maybe a very small synopsis of the data that the instrument's collecting. So you have to go visit them. And typically in the deep field in the Antarctic, that's done by aircraft. So we have five aircraft and they will go out and visit these instruments once per year. And as you say, they'll quite often get there, swap an SD card or a hard disk, maybe, depending on the size of the instrument, depending on the amount of power that's available. And then they'll fly those back to probably our main research station on the Antarctic Peninsula, Rothera. And people will collect the data there, back it up onto disk and tape. And similarly, stuff that's collected on the ship, collects a much larger amount of data. It's got a slightly bigger satellite link, but still it's only in the 1 to 2 megabit range. Plus the ship is picking up instruments that have been deployed on the surface of the sea for a year at a time. So lots of moorings that we put in the sea, obviously they have no connection at all. So we collect this data from all sorts of different instruments, different areas, and ultimately we fly it back. The people that are returning from Antarctica will carry hard disks or tapes, and they will fly it back to Cambridge, and then it will be uploaded onto our central data storage system there. And that's really when all the data comes together and people can access it as a single block.
Yeah, well, there's a saying in the U.S. about data movement, about this, something along the lines of it's hard to beat a station wagon full of hard drives in terms of data transport. I mean, it's a similar experience for you loading them up on an airplane. But so go back to the deep edge or whatever you referenced it, the sensors out in the far edge where they've got to go and physically inspect these things. You know, it's funny because in talking to the Ducks Unlimited guys, they've got a problem with beavers, and the beavers mm-hmm. will build these dams, and they've got to use these photos that, you know, they face similar challenges to you that could either have visibility into what's physically happening there, or even just a teeny bit of sensor data that says water levels have risen. And that's an indicator that something has happened that's obstructed the water flow, and now someone's got to go out there and check and see if the beavers have done something terrible. Other than the storms and the harsh environment that you deal with down there, what are there other physical challenges that are unique to that harsh environment?
Obviously, the environment, as you said. And the biggest factor of that is cold. You know, you put a sensor out in the deep field in the middle of the Antarctic continent, it can get down to minus 50 degrees over the Antarctic winter, and a variety of things stop working. And then quite often the Iridium modems themselves will stop working in the cold. They recover very well when they warm up again a bit, but they... So it's not uncommon for things to go dark for a month or so in the middle of winter.
Well, that 50 degrees too is a European calculation of temperature,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's degrees Celsius. Yes.
Yes. So you've got the cold. Yeah, that's funny because electronics. So when we see, you know, a server, or a storage array, or even a sensor come into our lab here in Cincinnati and look at the spec sheet, they'll have operating temperature specifications. And we run an air-cooled lab here. And so Kevin, who runs our lab, will be very sensitive about, you know, how far can we push these things, especially in the summer, where it might be over 100 degrees Fahrenheit here, and making sure our servers are able to continue operating in an open air cooled environment. You know, those things seem like relative pansies now based on what you're dealing with down there in the harsh environments. It's amazing to me that any of it works at a certain point.
It is. I mean, we have a lot of very good electronic engineers who work for the British Antarctic Survey as well. And they've got a lot of years of experience now, in finding the right electronics, in actually building heating systems to keep the electronics at some kind of temperature which they can operate. And obviously we look for electronics that are specifically built for that environment or for cold environments. But even so, you mm-hmm. get to points at which things don't cope. I was gonna say, really, that sort of brings me on that the biggest thing that we face outside of that is actually power. You know, obviously there's no electric grid to plug all the equipment in there. So all the power that we use, certainly for the instruments, well, for everywhere, even on the Antarctic stations, all the power has to be generated by us. So the stations have diesel generators, but in the field, we can't really do that. That's not practical. So you rely an awful lot on battery power. We're fortunate, obviously, in the Antarctic, you get 6 months of sunlight. So solar power is a very good use of power. But then you have to store it for the winter. And over the winter, you get 6 months of darkness. We don't mm-hmm. yet have, as far as I'm aware, we don't have significant use of wind power. Because the conditions are so harsh, because the winds are so powerful, because of things like snow and everything else. So that really limits us to batteries, and then we have to eke out the power, and the power budget is a massive factor in what we can do, and it things like satellite communications tends to be quite high power usage, so that's a further limit on how long we can actually transmit, because we'll waste all of our power supplies on that rather than actually collecting the data.
Right, spinning up that modem, I've been told, is a pretty big hit on that overall power draw.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, that's often, you know, one of the biggest things in the systems that we build.
Do you run into trouble with any frisky critters, any birds or seals eating your sensors or doing anything crazy? I'm sure it happens.
It does happen, and I mean, we put sensors on animals. Where it's you know, where you can do on a seal, you can put some sensors on there. We do operate a little bit in the Arctic, where we do get polar bears being an issue for us. In the Antarctic, there's not a significant amount of sort of large animals that would cause us big problems like that. Certainly around the edges and some of the subantarctic islands, then yes, there are penguins, there are seals, there are birds that will, you know, you have to make your systems a little bit proof against that. But on the Antarctic continent itself, you're generally okay in terms of animals.
Wait, so how much goes into, you know, rigging these sensors and devices for your own use? I mean, I know you talked about finding things that are hardened for the cold, but I mean, that's got to be a much more limited set of devices that you can buy off the shelf and go just, you know, plunk them down in the middle of your frigid climate there. You know, I can't imagine you can just roll up to Dell or HPE and say, I need something that's rated for, you know, -100 Fahrenheit and, you know, go put an IoT device out of the box out in the wild. So do your scientists have to be, you know, this is an old reference, a MacGyvers of some sort to put these things together, you know, bespoke for their projects? I'm kind of curious how much hardware manipulation there is to even be able to collect the data.
There is quite a lot. We have a lot of electronic engineers, and we have a lot of mechanical engineers. We have a lot of people who do build systems very much in that way. They find low power system on chips. They find things like Arduinos or other small electronic systems. There's a whole range of obviously small systems that we put together, and then we build everything from the cases, the electronics. Wind is a big issue there, so actually securing these things down on the ground so they stay where they are, making sure they don't sink in the snow. You can get several meters of snowfall, so you've got to make sure they can cope with that. There's a whole range of challenges, and that pretty much all is done by our in-house people, who obviously have built up years of experience in finding what works, and finding ways to actually build these systems to cope in those kind of environmental conditions.
These people are a bit of a group of masochists then, aren't they? To be able to deal with these environments. That's funny. So that's the edge, and the data, as you described, moves, you know, progressively by hand or teensy bits by satellite back to the research stations. Do the research stations have formal data centers? I mean, I'm sure it's not racks of gear, but they must have something to help start to aggregate this data as it comes in.
They do now. I mean, there's a, like you say, it's not big racks. It's a rack generally per station, and they have effectively a normal office computer network in there. They have servers. Everything has to be local. You know, again, their satellite links are not very big, so there's very limited amounts of cloud computing that we can use from the Antarctic. So we have a full setup of, you know, virtualized servers, storage, backup, the whole lot. And that's where people start to aggregate the data. They can do some processing on it, and they have a full network that runs for that research station.
So virtualized, is that VMware or is it something else?
It's generally VMware. And really, it's been a virtualization has been really useful to us because we're out very remote, because our, you know, you can't get a replacement part, you know, the next day delivery. Typically, you know, if one of our research stations, Halley Research Station, which at the moment, because of the movement of ice on the, it sits on a floating ice shelf, and because there's cracks in the ice shelf, it's not safe to leave people there over the winter. So that actually is completely unmanned and automated. So that will go. But even with people there, the ship visit is sort of finishes in about March and doesn't happen again until usually Christmas, New Year time. So that can go for 9 months with no outside world visits at all. So everything that we take into the Antarctic, you have to take all the spares and everything with you. So we really want to minimize the amount of kit that we take to do anything really, because we don't want to take lots of extra spares with us. It's extra costs, and it's actually logistically a challenge. If you're sending things in by ship or you're sending things in by small planes, then you don't have a lot of cargo capacity.
So reliability for you starts to become really maybe more critical when you think about however many nines of availability, you know, get quoted on a system. You suffer more severely than the standard enterprise if you have to replace a drive or a power supply, or, you know, God forbid, something more critical like a CPU or something. You know, that's a big hit for you guys. And I'm also thinking about the power envelope too that you were talking about before. So have you made an investment in low power servers or flash or other things to specifically to go after either the reliability or power envelope issues?
We haven't done as much of that as you'd necessarily think at the moment. And I think probably because the IT kit that's on the stations is generally not massive compared to everything else that takes the power budget when you're heating the stations, when you're running a location for people to live in. As I say, you've got some diesel generators, so generally we're not suffering too much from power usage on the stations. We want to minimize our power usage. We want to move to renewable energies as much as possible. You know, fuel is expensive. Transporting fuel to the Antarctica is expensive. So we certainly don't want to, be profligate with the fuel we use. But generally, IT-wise, we can actually get away with a standard, you know, you go to Dell, HP or somebody like that, and you can take a standard server. And that's sufficient. We just take a complete spare server. And as I say, the great thing now is you virtualize all of the hardware. So really, you can take in one reasonably powerful server, and that runs your entire IT operations, and then the exact same spec as a spare, and just make sure you have power supplies and hard disks and things. You have enough of those to last you for a year if they break.
Well, it sounds like you guys would be one of the perfect examples of where hyperconverged would be a fit. Have you guys explored that just from the operational simplicity and resiliency perspective, or are you still, you know, kind of server storage networking, you know, standard?
We are still the standard stack. We are still server and storage. And we do have, in a sense, we're hyper-converged. I mean, it's not really hyper-converged, but we have, you know, you can, in a standard Dell server, for example, there's enough hard drive bays that you can put in sufficient data. We're not talking massive amounts of storage at these locations. We're talking tens of terabytes at most. So you can fit that in a standard server. And as prices come down, as you say, we move to mm-hmm. we move to flash storage for reliability and for performance and so on. We've looked at some hyper-converged solutions. They tend to require cloud connections for management at the moment, and that has been a big reason why we can't go down that route, or we haven't yet found a solution that lets us go down that route. And as the data rates, you know, as the amount of data we're storing increases, as the processing we do locally increases, I'm sure it's something we'll look again in future. And as we start to, we're starting to move towards clustered systems to give us increased reliability and ease of use, because we can't always have IT support at these sites. So you're having the systems run by scientists or support staff who are not in any way IT trained. We give them some training before they go in-house, but we try to make the systems as simple as possible, so they need to do a little more than just follow our instructions over the phone and maybe swap a hard disk or two.
So you're telling me if you've got a server failure, Dell doesn't offer next day on-site or 4-hour on-site service plans
so far,
for Antarctica?
They haven't managed to send somebody out in 4 hours, no.
Wow, you've got to step up the game. I mean, with everything as a service these days, you know, serviceability is a big part of that. So that's funny. So your storage footprint then in the science stations is relatively light. It sounds like mostly because it's a lot of sensor data and maybe less photographic or real heavyweight kind of file data like that. Is it different then on the research ships, the vessels themselves? Or it would seem like then maybe they're doing a little more of that, you know, mapping the ocean floor or whatever, where some of that data might get heavier.
That's right. There is, the stations are really there to send people out into the deep field. So they deploy the sensors there. And as we've talked about the power issues, that does tend to reduce what you can collect. On the ships, the aircraft carry some radar and do some larger data collections, but it's where the ships that we that generate the sort of vast amounts of data in our terms, and the ships, certainly the new research ship, the Sir David Attenborough, has a lot of echo sounders on board, looking at both the ocean floor, the sub ocean surface, and the full water column. And if you run those sensors and those echo sounders in their full sort of 3D mode, then you can generate tens or hundreds of terabytes a day. And that becomes sort of big data in our terms.
So you were talking about data collection in the ships, and you've got the new Attenborough coming online soon. But what does the data center look like in a ship then, if you're going to start talking about terabytes or even petabytes of data? A data center, a floating data center, is a different sort of challenge from a technology perspective, I imagine.
It is. In some ways, we end up just, we build a server room, you put some racks in it, and then you put sort of fairly standard hardware in those racks. So yes, on the existing vessel, the James Clark Ross, that has some servers and some external storage connected. On the new vessel, that's going a bit more reliable. And as I say, we're going down the, you know, you've got a clustered server setup now, and we have a storage area network, an iSCSI storage area network with some quantum disk storage, some of the quantum QXS hybrid storage in there, and you build a small data center that is, again, as we've been saying, it's the traditional model of servers and storage independent rather than hyper-converged, but it is a fairly standard data center in that respect.
Yeah, I know. You've got a lot of new gear going into this, and you're even using some tape libraries, which is makes actually a lot of sense because we talked about filling up a station wagon with hard drives, filling up a suitcase with tapes to get the data off the ship or off the continent and back up to the UK for, you know, integrating with your more formal data center and then running your analytics or whatever else happens up there is a pretty strong use case. Do you guys, obviously hard drives are what, 18, 20 terabytes now, but tape is far in excess of that. Is that a pretty common motion then to fill up a duffel bag with tapes and head home with it?
That is. So it's, I mean, we switched over the last few years to using standard external hard drives. We've been using the ones sort of, you know, 1 to 4 terabyte size hard drives. Just mm-hmm. plug into your laptop, make a copy from the server on board and take the data back. And that's the existing research ship, which will generate, say, 1 to 10 terabytes in a research cruise. As we move to the new vessel and we generate possibly two orders of magnitude more than that, if we're generating several hundred terabytes in a research cruise, then that becomes a bit more complicated. As you say, you can't, it's difficult to copy lots of data onto hard drives and then end up with lots of hard drives everywhere to bring back. So this is where tape libraries really come into their own, I think. So we've bought some of the quantum i3 scalar libraries that using LTO-8 tapes. They're mm-hmm. physically small, so they fit on the vessel. I mean, it's a 130 meter long ship, but it's full of a lot of equipment and there's not massive amounts of space for these sorts of things. So we can put these libraries on the ship. We're looking at LTFS as the linear tape file system to allow us to treat them whilst they're on board as a slow disk storage, really. And then we can make a copy of the data. We'll get up to maybe 30 terabytes per tape. So we might end up with 3 or 4 tapes that we can then take out as a set and bring them back to the UK and then transfer the data from there onto our main data platform.
Well, so you obviously have the data. So say in the Attenborough case, when it's out and collecting this larger set of hundreds of terabytes on a cruise, you can hold that on the ship for some time and I suppose confirm, you know, wait to confirm your copies have made it back to the UK and you've, you know, rehydrated that into your archive systems or whatever and have validated that you have the data, because data management then back at the ship is going to be a problem. Eventually you can have your fixed amount of storage on the ship, but eventually you're gonna have to delete something. Do you guys, you must get a little nervous about that process though. Do you back up? Like what are you doing in these ship or remote data centers to ensure that you've got copies and you can hold on to them, because you've got some physical risk, not that, you know, that anything terrible has happened, but you know, when you're talking about a physical location, you know, on Earth, a tornado could take out a data center, and if you haven't copied that data off somewhere else, then you've got a problem. What do you guys think about from a data protection perspective?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we have a physical data center on the ship, and it is at risk. You know, probably fire is the biggest risk that we face. And obviously the ship can sink. We hope very much that it doesn't.
Probably not, but.
And, you know, in that case, obviously the first priority is to make sure that the people are safe and well. And so the data would come as a secondary point there. But yes, once it's, so, but we will, you then have all the other types of errors that are much more common. You have straightforward human error. I can accidentally delete data if I do the wrong thing on board. We can have hardware failure. Yes, you've got RAID storage, you've got redundancy, everything like that. You can still obviously get get firmware issues, software bugs, and so on, so you can have data deleted. So we will make a daily backup. We'll back that up to disk and to tape on board the ship as a fairly standard backup routine. And yes, my aim in designing the equipment for the new vessel has always been that we can cope with at least two cruises worth of data, and hopefully more, so that we don't have to delete the data immediately. You can make a copy to take back to the UK, whilst you can still keep that copy on the ship. Then you get back to the UK, you restore the data, you can run checksums at both locations, and once you're fairly sure that the data has been copied as you expect, then you can get to the point of deleting the data from the ship when you need the space for future cruises. So I would go on.
Yeah. So you're virtualized on the ship. I'm curious what you're using for backup then.
So on the ship, it's Veeam. We use Veeam for backup.
Okay.
And we just do on the new vessel, we now have a second NAS solution, a Synology NAS in this case, which acts as our immediate backup target, and then one of the quantum libraries, tape libraries, is our tape backup target on the ship.
Huh. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, that's a good use case for that, and relatively low cost, but you still get a good reliability profile, considering. Okay, so we've got the data off the ship back to the... Oh, one thing I wanted to ask you too about environmentals, and on the ship you've got movement that you wouldn't have in a data center for your hard drives. Have you had any sort of increased failures or expected increased failures for hard drives on a ship like that?
Surprisingly, we haven't. We don't see a significant increase in failures like that. I'm always quite surprised by that. Yes, the racks.
You thought you would have more, huh?
I do think we would have more in it. And really, the movement, whilst can be quite extreme. The ship can roll sort of up to 25, 30 degrees from side to side, and that's a big movement when you're on board there. It's relatively gentle. The racks are mounted on vibration dampeners. The thing that always surprises me is that these are ice breaking ships, and when you break ice, you go full speed into the ice. You come to quite an abrupt halt. You back off and you repeat that, and you do it again, and you can do that for days at a time. And the whole ship vibrates. The engines are going full power, and then hitting the ice with the weight of the ship. So you've got 15,000 tons of ship crashing into an ice floe. That really does vibrate the whole ship, and it is pretty constant for, as I say, for hours or days at a time. And it's surprising that we don't actually get a lot of disk failures. Relatively standard hard drives cope pretty well with that, it turns out.
Well, how did you hold up? Have you experienced the ramming of the ice on one of these ships?
I have, and I mean it. You can it can make you unsteady in your feet. You have to be aware of your surroundings. I know.
I would think it could make you unsteady in your bowels. Actually,
I'm very fortunate in that I don't get seasick, so I cope well with that, and it's one of the reasons why I've spent so much time on the ship, is because I like the environment and I don't get seasick. I know of colleagues who you'll be standing maybe having a shave in the morning and you'll suddenly bang your head against the mirror because the ship has struck some ice. things like that do happen. Things slide around, things fall off desks. I've had, you tie everything down, you screw everything down at the desk. I've had computers shake themselves out of their mountings and fall on the floor, and that does tend to be pretty terminal for them.
I can imagine the number of broken screens, iPads and laptops that have been destroyed by crashing to the ground.
Absolutely. I mean, it's something you learn very early on when you go to sea that everything has to be securely tied down or in a drawer or something like that. If you leave something on a desk, it will fall off, especially in the seas that we operate in. They are rough. There's big swells there. Things do fall off. Things do break. So you have to be very conscious of where all of your kit is at all the time. But put something in a rack that's bolted to the ship, and that tends to, you know, that does actually survive very well. That's a very good place for things to be.
Do you run into any, you're thinking of environmentals, do you run into any issues with humidity? Because that certainly changes the cooling profile of these, you know, servers and storage arrays and whatnot. I'm wondering if that's been a problem or an issue, maybe more on Antarctica than the ship.
We monitor it. We have climate control systems in place for the server room so that we can dehumidify the air and we can cope with it. I mean, Antarctica itself is a very dry continent. It actually has low precipitation. So from that point of view, we don't suffer too much from that. We do suffer sometimes on the ship. We do actually suffer from a buildup of heat. The server rooms tend to be in the bowels of the ship, in the middle, and you can hit issues with heat buildup, especially as the ships are designed to operate in the Antarctic, but to get there they have to travel through the tropics. So quite often you spend 2 or 3 weeks a year in the tropics, and that can cause you some heat issues with your server rooms on board. But generally, you know, we have good AC in there, and we tend to cope with that fairly well.
Well, it sounds like a relative vacation then. for the server guys. So on the ship itself, do you have dedicated IT people? Is there enough room to have an IT skunk down there?
So there is, and so this is where I've spent a lot of my time in Antarctica, because the ship is a very expensive platform to operate. You're talking tens of thousands of pounds per day to run a vessel like this, from the fuel point of view, from the people living and working on board. You have an IT person on there as an insurance policy, and to help out with the, you know, making sure that the data collection is working as everybody expects. So I and my colleagues will typically spend 6 weeks at a time on the ship doing a scientific cruise, and looking after, you know, some of it is plain old office IT. You'll get issues with Microsoft Word or Excel or email or things like that. You know,
the Wi-Fi's down.
The Wi-Fi's down. There's a lot of paperwork the captain, the chief engineers have to fill in. So, you know, the printer's broken. All of that kind of stuff goes on. So we're on there to support that. But then, obviously, our real mission is to support the science and to make sure that the data collection is working. The ship runs sort of continuous underway sampling of the sea and the atmosphere. So we look after those systems and we make sure they go. And then all of the sort of specialized research systems that collect from the ocean, we also make sure we can collect the data from that and store it safely.
So, you know, as I think about, you know, what a traditional enterprise might be facing as they deal with, you know, similar issues of distributed sensors pushing computing to the edge, you know, the popular concept now is analytics at the edge. And while that one is a little more challenging for you guys because of, you know, all the environmentals and other issues that you've highlighted, is there anything that you've learned in your journey in managing all of this remote data and remote devices that you think is useful or translates to an organization that's thinking about that or struggling with that, those types of deployments?
I mean, certainly I'm always amazed by how much you can actually do over very low bandwidth links. That's always our biggest challenge is the bandwidth to the edge, in this case, the actual bandwidth of the ship. And even when I'm not on board, and you're connecting to the ship over a satellite link, a high latency, low bandwidth link, You can actually get a lot done if you're just patient. I mean, we can transfer, you know, I'll transfer gigabytes of data, which people nowadays will think is an insignificant amount. But I can transfer gigabytes of data back. It will take several days to do from some of our locations. It can take, you know, a week or two, but if you just leave it on trickling in the background, it gets there eventually, and that's still quicker ultimately than waiting for a ship or an aircraft to visit that location and pick somebody up and fly back with it. So from that point of view, you can do quite a lot with very small amounts. We're constantly fighting, you know, everything is for quite valid reasons, everything is moving sort of cloud-based, and that's always a challenge to us. Again, you know, when you're sitting on a ship, and even if you've got, you know, even with your satellite link, it is a satellite link, you're on a moving platform, we've got dishes that track the satellite and so on, but depending on where you are on the earth, or depending what the weather's like, you can lose connection at any point, so that becomes something we have to watch out for. And again, that's you know, you try and make sure that you're self-contained entirely in your location. But yeah, I think it's, you know, standard IT equipment really is quite good, and with enough spares, you can make these things work quite well.
Well, yeah, we've got obviously the 5G, and in the UK, same sort of thing, rollout that they've been talking about now for seemingly half a decade to enable all these next gen devices and self-driving cars and, you know, smart cameras at intersections and all of these things. I suppose there's no T-Mobile tower in most of Antarctica, but is there any upside with some of these new satellite operators that are trying to bring higher speed to, you know, not just your area, but all over the world?
There is, and there's something I am really looking forward to. I'm really quite excited by what these operators could provide. And the benefit to us is that most of these satellite, or as far as I'm aware, all of these satellite operators, the actual bandwidth you get is related to the number of users in that location. So if they're broadcasting,
you've got an advantage there.
Absolutely, if they're broadcasting over a big city in the US or the UK, then you're sharing that satellite footprint with millions of other people. We are the only people out there, so we will get the full bandwidth to ourselves. So that's a benefit from us. And yeah, once we start getting into the gigabit speeds, that will radically change what we can do. We already deploy automated vehicles from the ship, and they do low bandwidth communications back, and you send them very small text files of where to go and what to do. But once you get high speed connections, you can put cameras on there, you can watch in real time what's going on.
Sure.
That means that, you know, it will revolutionize what you can do. You don't have to send very expensive people to the Antarctic. They can work remotely from around the world, and they can monitor and they can perform science from their home locations, which will be a massive change for the way we operate. Obviously, it's some time off yet, but it's something to watch out for.
Well, yeah, it sounds like from a technology perspective, that's the game changer for you is the bandwidth, and then, you know, that'll change the weight of other things like battery consumption and how you manage your solar window and all those other things. But yeah, that sounds pretty cool and seems like a pretty good use for technology to get the data from your sensors and scientists and ships back to the home data center for analysis. I mean, if you condense that window, then you're getting results faster and all sorts of accelerant applied to your research.
Yes, I mean, obviously, I mean, power still is an issue, as you say. But if we've got if we can have sensors in the field transmitting significant amounts of data back to us in real time, then yeah, it will revolutionize the science that's done, and it will really change just just, you know, as you say, the once you start getting that kind of data in real time, it's a network effect, and the amount that you can do becomes so much more. So those will have a massive impact on our operations.
Well, you know, this has been a phenomenal talk, Jeremy. I really appreciate you coming on. I don't want to hear any other enterprise or IT vendor ever complain about data collection or sensors at the edge ever again. So I'm gonna replay the part about digging through a couple feet or meters of snow to find your sensor after it's been buried or eaten by a seal or whatever. So yeah, this has been great. I think we can all learn a lot from your experience from the data transport scenario and data protection and the work you're doing with Quantum on their arrays and tapes. And it's really cool. So just definitely appreciate you taking the time and giving us a really special perspective into this part of the research world.
Yeah, thanks very much. I mean, it is. I do feel very lucky that I get the chance to do this and to experience the environment like that. So yeah, it's nice to share it with people. Thank you.
Well, fantastic. Appreciate you coming on.
No problem.